Thanks very much indeed. Thank you, Wayne, for that. Wayne is the only person I know who gets excited about church business meetings, and used to get a really encouraging note the next morning about how well things had gone and everything else, and everybody else tends to dread them, but Wayne finds them really exciting, and he's a real encourager. And if you're not on his prayer list, if you're not getting the emails that he sends out probably a couple of times a week, do get onto them and find out what he's up to. It's a real encouragement to know what God's doing. We're in the middle of a series on David's life and connecting it to some of the, connecting it to some of the Psalms. And in particular, we're following the story of David's life through the book of Chronicles. And we'll just take a little look at 1 Chronicles chapter 26. This has obviously sort of raised a lot of eyebrows with those that are doing the teaching. I'm responsible for having put this together. And so most weeks I get an email from somebody saying, Terry, what on earth were you thinking of? Can you give me some clues about how we might fit this together? And I've had a lot of really fun email conversations over the last few weeks with different people. Page 429, 1 Chronicles, chapter 26. We're not going to read it all. And most of it is stuff that's entirely incomprehensible to us. So we'll only read bits until our incomprehensibility takes over and we have to move on. Chapter 26, verse 1. The divisions of the gatekeepers. From the Korahites, Meshelemiah, son of Korah, one of the sons of Asaph. Meshelemiah had sons, Zechariah the firstborn, Jediel the second, Zebediah the third, Jethneel the fourth, Elam the fifth, Jehohanan the sixth, and Elioenai the seventh. And so it goes on through a group of people. And then we move on. Obed-Edom's son, Shemaiah, also had sons who were leaders in their father's family because they were very capable men. And there's another list of names. Meshelemiah, verse 9, had sons and relatives who were able men, 18 in all. Hossa, the Merarite, had sons. Shimri the first, although he was not the firstborn, his father had appointed him the first. Hilkiah the second, Tabaliah the third, and Zechariah the fourth. The sons and relatives of Hossa were 13 in all. Sorry, what's happened?
Your car alarm's going off.
Is that my car? I was thinking, oh, horrors. I was thinking, I hope that alarm that's going off there isn't ours. The gatekeeper, yeah, the gatekeeper of the car is going to go in. Do you know? Oh, okay, I won't ask any more questions and I won't worry about it either. But you can all pray quietly that nobody's sort of prizing. There's nothing to get out of it, actually, but that nobody's prizing it open. sorry about that. And then the divisions of the gatekeepers, through their leaders, had duties for ministering in the temple of the Lord, just as their relatives had. Lots were cast for each gate according to their families, young and old alike. And then the lot for the east gate fell to Shelemiah. And then there's some other lots that come out. And then God, verse 16, God was alongside God. There were 6 Levites a day on the east, 4 a day on the north, 4 a day on the south, and 2 at a time at the storehouse. As for the court to the west, there were 4 at the road and 2 at the court itself. And then we read in verse 20, their fellow Levites were in charge of the treasuries of the house of God. We've got one treasurer, I think. They seem to have had zillions of them who looked after the money coming in. The descendants of Ladan, who were Gershonites through Ladan, and who were heads of the families belonging to Ladan the Gershonite, were Jehiel, the sons of Jehieli, Zethem and his brother Joel. They were in charge of the treasuries. From the Amorites, the Izharites, the Hebronites, and the Uzielites. And then there's another load of names, and so on. Tells us in verse 31, as for the Hebronites, Jeriah was the chief according to the genealogical records of their families. In the 40th year of David's reign, a search was made in the records, and capable men among the Hebronites were found at Jazer in Gilead. Jeriah had 2,700 relatives who were able men and heads of families, and King David put them in charge of the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh for every matter pertaining to God and for the affairs of the king. So, treasurers and gatekeepers. And I want to approach this by perhaps looking at the thing that's really intrigued me most as I've thought about this whole series, which is, what is the story of your life? If somebody had to tell your life, and maybe one day somebody will tell your life, what will that story be? I think most of you know that I've been working for a while on my mum's biography with her, and that we've managed to find somebody else to take it over, and I think she'll have it done by Easter, and have a chance to see it in print by then. But it's really quite interesting when you try and tell somebody's story to work out what's really important in it and what is perhaps less important. And of course, things that matter to me as a child, as a son in the family, might not matter to people outside at all. And I guess if you think about David's life, there might be a list of names that come up, a list of Goliath, perhaps, the giant that he fought against. Maybe think about Jerusalem, the city he finally conquered. He and his men snuck up through the water shaft and they took the city. And the inhabitants were so secure that nobody could take the city that they said, even the blind and lame can keep you out. And David said, I bet they don't. And he got in there and he conquered the city. Maybe you think about Jesse, his father, the lion and the bear that he killed when they came to capture his sheep. Maybe you think about the Psalms that he wrote, about Samuel who anointed him king. There are some positive names there, aren't they? Jonathan, that friendship that survived despite the fact that they were in many ways competing dynasties. Bethlehem, the place he was born, and the place that his great, 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 whatever it was, grandson was born. And we remember that at Christmas time. Abigail, the wife that perhaps it's a bit sad to see how she fades from the picture. Absalom, the son who rebelled against him. Bathsheba, perhaps the most shameful story in the whole of his life. Joab, a very, very difficult character. Essential, really, to David's success as a general, and yet really an unpleasant person in many ways. How would you describe that life? And what's really interesting is we have two completely different narratives in the Bible. We have one narrative that is told in 2 Samuel, in which everything is told, the good, the bad, and the ugly. 2 Samuel tells the story of him becoming king, of him moving the ark, and that's the first example, really, of how much worship really mattered to David. And he moves the ark up from the place where it's been parked, eventually to Jerusalem. He doesn't do it in one go because he has a tragic setback as he sets out to do that. David wants to build something more than just a temporary tent for God's presence. He wants to build a temple. And God says, yes, but your hands are covered in blood. A man of peace will build it. Your son will build the temple. His victories. In the time of Saul, David, and Solomon, Israel moved from being a persecuted minority who sort of stuck to the hill country and little enclaves of resistance against the Philistine overlords to the people who ran the whole country. They overthrew the Philistines and they conquered most of the tribes and nations around them. And particularly under Solomon, they enjoyed the richest and most fabulous of times. And David's victories were really critical in moving them from that sort of resistance fighter mode to becoming the lords of the manor. Bathsheba, Absalom, lists that don't do anything for us, and they're full of things that meant something to the people at the time. Lists of people, lists of things, the intrigues, and the plotting that went on in the palace. And in fact, if you look at 2 Samuel, you get a picture of David who sort of gradually loses it in the palace as he becomes more and more affluent and sort of everything takes on a life of its own, and David never really seems to be in charge if you read that story. And then the bizarre story of him counting the army. What's that all about? God didn't want him to do it, and God punished him for doing that. And you have that story, which gives you a very, very mixed picture of David's life. And then you have the story that's told in 1 Chronicles. And in 1 Chronicles, this person who writes it, or the people who write it, have decided to tell a completely different story about David. It's not different in terms of things that happened. They're not making up a whole lot of new things, but they spend time focusing on a different set of priorities. And there are things that are similar. There are loads of lists in 1 Chronicles, all kinds of stuff, baffling and blinding detail at times. Moving the ark is important. That's important to the story because the chronicler is determined to point out the worship that dominates and drives David's life. He wants his life to be dedicated towards creating a place where God will be worshipped. And so moving the ark is a story that the chronicler tells, wanting to build the temple. David's victories are in there too, and you will have done them, I think. Matthew, a couple of weeks ago, did something on one of the Psalms, looking at David at war and stuff like that. Counting the army is also in there. And it's the only negative story that the chronicler tells about David. David's story in Chronicles does not contain anything about Absalom or Bathsheba. So many of the things where he loses the plot, they're just not told. Why is that? This one story is told because God punishes David by punishing the land. And there's 3 days of plague. And the plague stops at a particular place, and David buys the place where it stops. And that's the place where the temple is built. And so it matters that even in his weaknesses, there has been a focus on worship. And so if we tell the story the way that 2 Samuel tells it, we have a man who's good in battle, but a very mixed performance once he settles down in the palace. And indeed, one of the really interesting things is the way that they tell the succession narrative. In 2 Samuel, everybody is plotting, and Solomon's big brother declares himself as king, and he starts to hold a feast to have himself recognized as King David's successor. And it looks as though the succession isn't going to go to Solomon at all. It looks like a very hairy thing that almost doesn't come off. And to the chronicler, there's never any question about who is going to build the temple, because that's the great story in David's life, a story of worship. And so he is successful in war, but there is this enduring focus on worship. And so many of these passages that we've put together with some of the Psalms over the last few weeks and over some of the weeks to come are all to do with David's preoccupation with how this temple is going to work. Even here, there isn't a temple when these gatekeepers are put together. It hasn't been built yet because David hasn't handed over, but he foresees what is going to happen. And probably most of these people, one of them, towards the end of the chapter, we noticed that in the 40th year of David's reign, a search was made. The 40th year of his reign was the very last year of his reign. He reigned for 7 years in Hebron, and then he ruled over all Israel for another 33 years. And so in the very last year, some of this stuff is being done as he is a dying man. And probably those rotas, those schedules, would have carried on into Solomon's reign. And the thing that really matters to him is that there is a place for God to be worshipped. And for us, we're left with all of these details. Who did what when? Who sang when? Who was gatekeeper? Who was on the door? You know, we have massive problems with relatively simple rotas here. Alan's put it on a better footing. Perhaps he's the Asaph of our day, I don't know. But at the moment, there are some, and you get an email when you're going to do something now. And the rotas sort of work a lot better than they used to, and they're all centralized, and you can work out whether there's a clash between you on one rota and you on a different rota. And we're getting sort of stuff together, but we don't eulogize over our rotas in the way that David people did. He's fascinated by who's going to do what in God's house when. They say, don't they, that churches are like helicopters. If you don't watch out, you get sucked into the rotas. And that's what happens all the time, isn't it? And for us, we find the rotas are a little bit of a pain, really. And we have arguments, sometimes friendly, sometimes less so, about which priority, which rota takes precedence over which other rota. But for David sees this as the great offering that he and his people will make to his God. And I was struck as we put these two passages together that we've got the planner and the pilgrim. David is still planning ahead for a time when there will be a place where people can come and worship God. Enough room for everybody to come and worship. A solid place that will endure. A place where they can lavish their riches. And again, when we talk about refurbishing this place, you know, we worry a little bit. Nobody, as far as I know, has suggested putting gold on the walls, gold plate on every single wall, okay? They spent a lot of money on the temple. They amassed huge amounts of wealth, silver, gold, cedar wood, other things. Lots of stuff was brought together in order to beautify the house of God. The planner who looks ahead. And the pilgrim, where does the pilgrim fit in? Psalm 84 is a beautiful psalm. It's a psalm that's written almost certainly after the temple has been built. And two or three times a year, people would come to the temple to worship God. They weren't able, like we are, to just jump in a car and drive around the corner and be at church. Church, for many of them, the temple was a long way away. And the contrast is between, and it's in the psalm here, better is a day in your courts, verse 10, than 1,000 elsewhere. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God. And I thought that sort of provides a hinge, really, between these two passages. The idea of the doorkeeper who spends his whole life in the presence of God, and the pilgrim who's longing to go there. How lovely is your dwelling place, Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. The pilgrim has set out to go to the house of God. It's a difficult journey. It's an expensive journey. It's a journey that will cost them days and days. Do we have that kind of yearning to be in God's presence? Sitting next to somebody at a dinner the other night, and she keeps llamas, and she takes the wool, and I asked her whether she spun the wool, and she said that she didn't. I told her that my wife was on Ravelry and was sort of nuts about knitting and stuff like that, and she said, well, she tried it once, and apparently to get 1 ounce or something, it took about 2 hours spinning, and you need about 80 ounces of wool to make anything decent. And so she gave that up as a bad job, really. So she shears her llamas. But she said that she went to Peru, and that she did some work working with some women who kept llamas. And for them, it was a lifestyle choice. To keep it, and it kept them out of poverty, being able to have the llamas, getting the milk, getting the meat, getting the wool from the llamas. And she said that she went across there once, and some women had her, I think she'd helped them out by buying some llamas or something for them. And she said she wasn't feeling that good, and she was moaning about the hotel and everything. And she went to see these women, and they'd walked for 3 days to come and see her, to say thank you for the llamas that she bought them. 3 days. walking. 3 days there, 3 days back. We have it easy, don't we? We come, we go, we get on with other things. So the psalmist says, actually, that longing to be in God's presence really matters to me. And he says, the people that can spend their whole lives in the presence of God are really lucky people. There's a story in Exodus, and I just wanted to, it's only a verse, but if you've got your Bible, it's worth digging out your Bible, and the page number is there, it's page 92. There's just a little snippet about Joshua's life. Joshua is somebody that most of us think of as being a great general. It was Joshua, as the spiritual says, who fit the battle of Jericho. It was Joshua who went in first time round and conquered the land. And it tells us in verse 11 of chapter 3, it says that the Lord would, chapter 33, it says, the Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp. But his young assistant Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. Joshua was so taken up with being in the presence of God. And that's what this psalm is all about. It's about being in the presence of God. It's about the journey that people make. And my favorite verse in there is, as they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. Even the most desolate of territory that these pilgrims travel through as they go towards the place of worship, he says they transform the land. They said the desert flows with rivers when they're passing through it. I wonder if that's true of us. Would people say, the people that we work with, would they say, as Terry travels to his place of worship, he fills this place with floods and rivers and streams? Would they say it about you? That's your experience, that you fill everything around you with a sense of joy and expectation of God's presence. I don't know, but that's the challenge here in this psalm. As they go through, they go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. And the pilgrim thinks about all of the things that could be going on in his life. And he said, I'd rather be the doorkeeper. I'd rather be on the door. Actually, I'd rather guard. There's the idea of guarding the place rather than admitting people to it. I'd rather guard the place and be there than to do anything else. What is the story of your life going to be like? Who's going to write it? And what's it going to be like? I looked when I put pilgrims into my PowerPoint to see what would come up on clip art. This unusual picture came up, and of course, it's a different sort of pilgrim. It's the Pilgrim Fathers in the States, probably doing something that none of them would have been seen dead doing. But it struck me that it was a picture of pilgrims being joyful and communicating that sense of joy to those around them. I don't think dancing was allowed if you were a Puritan, but nonetheless, it's a great little picture there that reminds us of the joy that we could be sharing with those around us. Jacob's life is one that's a really interesting story. Jacob is mentioned here, isn't he? The God of Jacob. Hear my prayer, Lord God Almighty. Listen to me, God of Jacob. In Genesis chapter 14, Jacob is running. He's made a mess of his life. He has antagonized his older brother, who is now out to kill him. And he runs for his life, probably completely on his own. He may have had a servant with him, I don't know. But he's basically on his own. And he lies down in a desert in the middle of nowhere. And he has a dream that we all know about. And at the end, it's not Genesis 14. It's 17 chapters short of Genesis 35. It's 28, isn't it? Genesis 28. And he discovers that God is there, whether he realizes it or not. And he wakes up and he says, Jacob, verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I've set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Now, I don't know how you'd feel if somebody came to your door and knocked on your door and they said to you, if you look after me for the next however many years and you keep me safe and everything, then when I've finished my living and having fun, I'll come back to you and I'll give you a tenth of everything I have. I don't know what you'd think of that sort of deal. I don't know whether you would enter into dialogue with the person at the door. And it seems to me that Jacob has a little bit of neck to try and come to this deal with God. But God is good to him. And we tend to think of Jacob's life as being a series of disasters and difficult times. And it was a time, and there were disasters, and there were difficult times. But he does keep that promise. And he comes back to that place. And if you like, Jacob's life, up until that point that he comes back, is one big circle where God slowly brings him back to the place of worship. And in chapter 35 of Genesis, we find that he's not alone anymore. He's got a huge family with him. 35 verse 1, page 38. Then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there and build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. And he brings his entire family and they worship God in Bethel. Now, they're not a particularly holy family at that stage. If you read the story in the chapter ahead of time, they've just slaughtered a load of people. Right? It is they've one mess after another. The anger of two of the sons has boiled over, and it has made him a stench in the locality. And yet he comes, and he brings them all to a place of worship. Jacob said to his household, to all who are with him, get rid of the foreign gods you've with you, purify yourselves, change your clothes, come, let's go to Bethel. That's the great call that God makes on each of our lives. We can focus on the things that go wrong. We can focus on the bad things. We can judge other people in different ways. The thing that these Psalms remind us of, and that David's life reminds us of, is that his life was defined by his desire to worship God. And at the moment, you look around, and it's so easy for us. We see it all the time where people's lives are defined by the bad bits. It's the way that we seem to want to do things. What about my life? What about your life? How is it going to be defined? When the moving finger writes and then moves on, what will it have written? And you say, well, this is just sort of thinking about things the way you'd like them to be. This is escapism. This is just pretending that the bad things don't matter. And there's a sense in which it is pretending, but it happens to be God who's doing the pretending. He says we can come before him, and he will pretend that we're his son Jesus. And he can look at us, and he can say, actually, I don't see anything wrong with that person. There's another perplexing story in the book of Numbers. A king who doesn't like the Israelites. He calls a chap called Balaam to curse the Israelites. And Balaam wants the money because he's a prophet for hire. And he goes and God says, well, okay, if you really want the money, you can have it. But you can only say what I tell you to say. And the king has hired Balaam to curse the children of Israel. And it's quite a dark comedy, really, this story, because every time he goes to curse him, he ends up blessing them. And the king's getting angrier and angrier over all this money that he spent on hiring this prophet, and he can't get a single curse out of him towards these people, Israel. And one of the blessings that Balaam says when he looks out over the children of Israel, the king takes him up onto a mountain, and he says, "That's the people I want you to curse." And Balaam can only bless them, and he says, "No misfortune is seen in Jacob, no misery observed in Israel." And I think, how can God say that about those people? The narrative is full of their misfortunes. The narrative is full of the things that they've done wrong. They're grumbling, everything else. And God says, through Balaam, "I haven't heard it. I don't see it that way." How is your life going to be defined? What will happen in the end? Most of what Chronicles focuses on is probably the last few years, maybe the last few months of David's life. Most of the gospel stories focus on about the last week of Jesus' life, certainly the last 2 or 3 months of Jesus' life. Where's your story going to finish, and what's the worship angle going to be? And it seems to me that that's the critical challenge for us. We can be distracted by the things that we get wrong, and we all get so many of them wrong. Or we can say, actually, the call is to worship, and I will return, and I will worship. And like Jacob, it may be an uncomfortable experience. It may be something that, like the pilgrim that wrote Psalm 84, it may be just the fulfillment of that sense of longing. If you haven't got that sense of longing for God's presence, then you need to pray for it. You need perhaps to join with the prayer team at the front. But to be driven and drawn by that sense of longing is a wonderful blessing, and it will be fulfilled in the end. So thanks very much indeed.